Welcome to OC Housing Connection Program, Orange County's number one trusted resource for all your real estate and home mortgage news. Here are your hosts, Hamid and Faye Hamadachi.
Hello, everyone. We hope you had a fun and relaxing weekend. Let's get started today by talking about the Federal Reserve, history of Federal Reserve, and what it actually does that affects us all every day. I'm here with my co-host, Faye.
Hello.
As well as our sound engineer, Paul.
Always anxious. You know, we had people writing in after that last one and said, you guys usually know all the answers. We even sounded confusing talking about the Fed last week here.
I know.
Yeah, it's that's why we want to talk more about it so that we can get everybody
so,
more.
So give us a little bit synopsis of what's happening and where are we with interest rates. And then from there we can discuss
Let's talk about some economic news. The consumer spending was up 0.01%. Lower than what the it's not better. Like, you know, the low energy prices is continuing to depress the overall U.S. Inflation. You remember we talked about deflation before too.
It costs less for gas and costs less to get food because the trucking costs are less. Everything's making less. So it's not, we're not seeing an increase in the price of food and the basic other things that they used to
track. Right.
Remember how we need to get rid of our debts is by inflation. And it doesn't look like we're going anywhere with that.
We're not going to inflate them away.
We cannot inflate them away as much as we would like to. Well, the income has been rising faster, but the Americans are saving more money.
Which is good in a way.
Personal saving rate hit 5.4% last month. It's the highest since the end of 2012.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing, actually, because in 2008, when we had the mini recession or great recession, as it's called, there was no saving. In fact, people were negative. They had spent everything plus.
Don't talk too soon because the consumer spending, consumer spending generates 2/3 of the U.S. economic output.
I know, so we're reliant on them being crazy a little bit here. Yeah.
When we don't spend, that means our fourth quarter, our GDP numbers are probably going to be lower. Like the last time, it was estimated to be 1.5%, but the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta now models predicted a growth of 0.06%, which is almost 1% lower than what they were predicting before.
Yeah.
They will put out the estimate for the GDP in April 28th. So not too good of a news.
I'm with Hamid. I think this is actually kind of good news that people are saving more and spending. I think long-term health to the economy, maybe not today or this year. But
I want to interject something, actually. Last week, I mentioned something. Why does the Fed have to increase the rates? Everything is great, you know, we can stay where we are.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, a couple of days later, I read an article that there is a section or a segment of the Federal Reserve that thinks the same thing.
Mm.
Now, Janet Yellen doesn't agree with this, but there is a certain number of the Federal Reserve governors and, you know, the people who make the decision that they think, why do we need to raise it?
Well, if you don't raise it, then you can't lower it. And
that's the argument that Janet Yellen is putting in front, that if we don't do anything, what happens later
then
on?
Then how do you control it? Then you have nothing to do. Just talk.
I think that's one of the reasons they want to raise it a little bit, so that in future, if we need to do something to get the economy going, we can lower it now.
It's a stimulus,
because right now it's close to zero. So let's say 2 years from now, we need to put some stimulus in the economy. If it's already at zero, you can't really go below zero. So that's one of the arguments they have.
We're still trying to recover from the last rates because part of the problems is because of the last raise. It really didn't do what we didn't do well with that raise. So, Yellen.
I think it's
going to
stay where we are right now. So that's not really.
Well, and if Faye's right at what she just said here, and I know she is, there's no sign of inflation on the horizon here, despite what everybody keeps thinking.
Exactly,
inflation's coming. If spending is low, if the consumer price index is low because
gas prices
mainly. So if things don't cost more, if people aren't spending more, if they're not making more, then that's not driving inflation.
But there is more There are more economists now that they think that we may have a recession in the next 12 months.
I've heard that many times too.
So that's, I think that's why Federal Reserve is being cautious, because if they do raise it, we could hit a recession. But, you know.
Now, one of the interesting things is, Paul, gas prices, when they were going up, it was actually hurting people a lot. I mean, when everybody was buying all these small cars and people were buying motorcycles to go to work.
Right.
Now, interestingly, when the prices come down, people are going back to gas customers. Whereas if they stayed with the same gas-saving cars and so on, there would be more money to be spending on the economy, which would get the economy going faster or better, because there's more money in your pocket. Now you can spend more money.
Here's a weird analogy, but we do the public policy show on Wednesdays, the City Square, and we talk a lot about water. Obviously, it's on everybody's mind. And the El Nino has been kind of the El No show, although it looks a little drizzly today. It hasn't been the deluge that people predicted. They're assuming, though, that someday it'll start raining again here and the reservoirs will fill up. Will we abandon all this water-saving stuff when we don't have... the heck with it. Let's just put grass back in. Let's water like crazy. Or are these things permanent changes? They're arguing it's more of a permanent change in our mentality, like recycling. We're just used to it. But your point is well taken. Once we get used to driving smaller cars and other things, we didn't seem to accept that. That didn't become the new norm.
Exactly. Now, I think with the water, Paul, though, we need to change some of the infrastructure we have. The way it was designed was, whenever it was designed in California, that whenever we have a big rain, we always have these channels that collect the water and goes to the ocean.
Right.
Because we never thought about
about collecting it. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, I think they need to change that infrastructure so when the water comes in, they have places to save it.
Exactly. Problem is, because of environmental rules, which I don't think are bad, but many people think are over burdensome, and because we're built out, where do you collect that water? There aren't big plots of land to build a reservoir.
I'm sure we can find places, though. I mean, all these flood channels just basically take the water right now to the ocean.
Yeah, right.
So we need to come up with some way of solution.
That's been the problem, though, because we've cemented all these channels in. The water doesn't seep into the ground reservoir, so we physically collect it, run it onto the ocean. That doesn't do any good in terms of collecting it or letting it even seep into the ground here.
Exactly. So I think eventually we will do this permanent.
But their point was, and I don't know if it's true or not, but they felt, several experts around our last show said, we think this is a permanent change, just as recycling is. People are used to recycling. They've accepted that they put some in one can and some in the other. They don't want to go back and just throw recycling out, nor do they want to suddenly change their water habits and suddenly put grass back in after they've ripped it out. But energy savings, no, they seem to be eager to run back to our wild spending.
You see all these gas guzzlers back on the market again, all the freeways, and yes, I agree. So,
and you still have to spend more money on that type of a car.
You do.
True, well, but see, imagine if you had a car, I mean, let's say just Toyota Prius.
Right.
And you kept that car, and you drove that car, then the price of gas went down, there'd be more money in your pocket.
Yeah.
Which means you have more money to spend or save, for that matter.
We seem to want to go back to that lifestyle, whereas other things we've had to conserve on, water or other things, we haven't had that desire to go. Electricity. We become more effective in using electricity in our homes. I don't know that people suddenly want to waste electricity, but we seem to want to waste gas now. Okay.
I think it's gradual, because if you go back to 1970s, if you remember, everybody used
to
drive these big, big, huge cars. Now, there's less of, I mean, there's less people wanting to drive those big cars.
Right. But they have gone back to trucks and things and stuff. Still the number one selling vehicle on the road today is a Ford F-150 pickup truck.
Right.
So. Well, I'm going to give you guys a little bit more economic news.
You're right.
The good piece of economic news was the pending home sale jumped 3.5%.
That was in February, right?
In February. Well, pending is basically people who have actually wrote offers and they're in process.
In escrow or something.
Some of them will probably cancel or some probably won't qualify. But that's been the highest in 7 months, the highest level in 7 months.
And does that reflect the seasonality you guys talked about in an earlier show? We're starting to head towards spring.
I think it's more actually...
It was higher than what it was expected.
It was probably because of the interest rates. The seasonality hasn't started yet. Hmm. We still are very tight on the inventory. Remember last week I talked about the price of the very luxurious homes being so high that the people who want to move up have a problem selling their homes and being able to find an affordable home to
and
move
then
up
it affects
to.
People all the way down the chain because
exactly.
the next people below them don't have houses to buy because I haven't moved to the bigger house.
So that actually is a problem, and I think we're going to have that tight inventory this summer too. You see, right after Memorial Day is when everybody starts looking very, very aggressively for buying a home.
Get it done before the kids start school in the fall.
Yeah. Exactly. So we're going to have a tight inventory, I think, mainly because of the fact that many people cannot sell and they're not putting their homes on the market.
I'm going to put you on the spot right now. Our price is going to go beyond where we're almost back to where we were before the Great Recession. Almost.
I think so. I think the prices are going to keep rising, mainly because there's not inventory. It's supply and demand.
Right.
As long as we have bigger demand for what's out there, people are going to be paying more for it.
Okay. Faye had something, yeah.
Sale of existing home fell 7.1% in February from January, but the pending sale rose. And then also January reading was revised down from initial report, the pending sale in January.
Remember, pending sale shows what's happening now.
Right.
The sales that you said fell is from previous, which makes sense because in November, December, and January, people must have gone into escrow. That's why it closed in February, for example.
Right.
Well,
so
less closed than what they
less have. Exactly. That means during those 3 months, which is normal.
I'm sure it's not because of loan qualification.
No.
Absolutely.
It's mostly
not.
Seasonal. November, December, everybody's thinking about holidays, vacations, buying gifts for Christmas.
And are these Orange County numbers or nationwide numbers?
This is nationwide.
Nationwide, okay. But it is actually a good indication of what's happening in Orange County, too.
That's why I was wondering, do we reflect the trend or do we beat? It seems like we're higher and we're better than the
county,
national.
In our county, remember, we keep going back to the same fact. In our county, there is a shortage, Los Angeles and Orange County.
If you want specific Orange County, I can give it to you.
Yeah.
It's 15.12% was sales activity. It was increased. In California, it was 8.8%. So, yes, Orange County, it is more
stuff selling.
Selling and it's more expensive because the median home price in Orange County was $704,000.
Wow.
California is $468,000.
Wow.
That is a big difference.
Big difference.
Now, unsold inventory in Orange County is 4.1, close to the same in California, 4.3. And then median time on the market, which means basically how long it takes for the home to sell, mm-hmm. in Orange County it was 64 days. In California, it's 44.5 days, which means it's selling faster, and I think mainly because of the median price being lower.
Yes, right. And is that across all categories? Is that pretty standard, whether it's high or low?
That's across all categories.
Okay.
That's basically the good indication of what's going on with everything.
Well, again, every week I come in here saying, is my house going to go up or down? That's what everybody wants to know here. And it
good
seems
news
like
is still going,
always go
it's still going up. It's still going up, unless, like Faye says, we actually hit a recession, and I don't see it being, even if it's a recession, I don't think it's going to be very severe.
Can I throw in another weird bit of information and take it for what it is? We have a financial show, The Strategic Investor, on Fridays, and they've had now several people come in. I know you're going to want to say who, and I don't remember who, but they were well thought of people in predictive economics here. And one was a fund manager for a big fund, mutual fund. And their theory was, heard this a couple times, that we're into for a number of years now a sort of flat stock market. That the stock market has been growing, whatever. It needs to either come down. Everybody's waiting for the correction that's long overdue. It's every 5 years, and it's been 6 or 7 years that it hasn't corrected. And they don't, for a while there, they don't see anything. And then beyond that 5-year period, huge growth. So there's a stagnant period.
I don't know much about stock market, Paul, to be able to comment. But from what I see, I agree with that. I remember about 2-3 weeks ago, the market was down very much so mm-hmm. for like 3 weeks or so. Everybody was, looking at doom and gloom, and then mm-hmm. it started going back up again.
Yeah.
One of the things that I kind of think is happening is that's the only place people can put their money in. It's with real estate, you have to have a lot of qualifications, down payment, having a job and being qualified for a mortgage and so on. With stock market, I only have $1,000 That's the place to put it.
Right.
Banks don't pay you very much right now. And in fact, almost 0% if you put it in the bank. So that's where people are going to put
it. And
their
the only
money.
Reason I bring it up in this show, because, again, like you said, there's only three places to put your money for most people. In the bank, and earn interest, like the Carter years, when it was better to put it in CDs in the bank and whatnot, because you could get 15, 18, 20%. That was the only period I ever know that was like that. Or you can put it into the stock market, which has had a big, huge bull run through the 90s, and then a big bust, and then another slow kind of bull positive run over the last 6-7 years as we've climbed our way out of the Great Recession, and it seems to be overdue for a correction, or into housing. And so the point that they were making is, if stocks are kind of, as they say, choppy, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up, and it kind of basically just stays flat year over year, people are going to start pulling money out of that and investing it in not the banks, not stocks, but in housing again.
I hope so. I mean,
just as a place to put park your money, you got to put it in one of those three places. Yeah. And people pulled it out of housing when it took such a nosedive, and they've been hesitant to sort of get back into the market in big ways. I'm talking about investors.
Something that's interesting psychologically: when people put their money in real estate and it goes up, they feel wealthier than if they put it in the stock market and
absolutely.
It goes up.
And they actually spend more money.
They actually spend more. Yeah,
exactly. That's an interesting point, and I don't know why that is, because in both cases you're getting wealthier.
I had some friends in the hot tub and backyard barbecue business and all that stuff way back when, 10 years ago. And there was a period before the Great Recession, your house had just doubled. Let's take out a home equity line. Let's build the swimming pool. Let's build the big patio and all the other stuff. Yet when their stocks went up, they were like, well, thank you, but I don't want to cash it
in.
Yet. Yeah.
Exactly. So
in
a way, it's better for the real estate to keep going up.
I think the prediction, if they're correct, the prediction is real estate's going to continue to climb for some time to come, maybe some minor corrections, but particularly in Orange County, it seems to be still growth for some time to come. And if the stock market goes down or remains uncertain and choppy, that may move even more money into commercial and home real estate.
That's very true. Now, one caveat here, home affordability, it's a major problem.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I know in California, it's in most parts of California, there are some areas that are affordable, but that's a major problem. That's something that the state, the counties, the cities are trying to address and see how they can do that.
Yep.
It is a problem, because if homes are not affordable, we can't, people can't buy it.
The whole thing grinds to a halt. Yeah, right.
I give you an example. One of my friends, a student at the University of San Francisco, he couldn't find an affordable place to rent as a student. Even sharing with other people.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. That's a major problem.
And it defeats the whole American dream. Are we going to places like San Francisco now mimic New York? The only two places I know of in the world where people who live there have no expectation of owning ever in their life. If you choose to live in the city or you choose to live in New York, you are just going to rent. I don't care if you're rich or poor, you're going to rent for the rest of your life.
I think San Francisco is almost there now.
Yeah.
It is almost there.
Would you say San Francisco is more expensive than New York or New York?
I want to say New York.
Okay.
But San Francisco is pretty close up there. San Francisco is,
And it's so expensive that the majority of people they've given up the idea of owning anything, a condo, an apartment, a home, anything. Yeah.
So, I mean, a small home. I had a client that moved actually from Orange County there, and half the size of his home, was over almost $1 million.
Yeah.
And he was surprised. He was shocked.
Well, if you want to live in those cities, you just can't find anything.
Are you done with the Nizu News, Faye?
Yes, I am.
Let's talk about the history of the Federal Reserve. I mean, not many people know about it. We are all affected by what they do every day. They change interest rate, they have the open market committee, etc. But many people don't even know how they came about and how they got there.
That's right. Or what they do.
Exactly. Originally, we've got to go back to American Revolution.
The American Revolution?
Oh, my goodness.
We have time to go far that far
well,
back.
Well, I try to be fast and, the Continental Congress printed the new nation's first paper money.
Okay.
This is between 1775 and 1791, and it was called Continentals. And this money was used to, for the war efforts and,
pay for the war.
But what happened was it actually led to the inflation, and it rapidly accelerated as the war progressed.
Because they just kept printing more and more.
Exactly. And then people lost faith in the notes, and that the phrase, not for the Continental, that's how it came about, which meant it's utterly worthless.
Right.
Now, in 1811, Secretary Alexander Hamilton, he was the first person who actually, Congress established the first Bank of the United States, mm-hmm. which was in Philadelphia. It was the largest corporation in the country and dominated by big banking and money interest.
And was that a public-owned institution or a public-private?
It was private. Yes.
Right.
That's why many people were so uncomfortable with such a large and powerful bank. The bank's charter expired in 1811, and then the Congress refused to renew it.
Right.
So again, we were back to not having a central bank.
Which meant no central currency either.
Exactly. So that meant the bank printed their own currency. Now, in 1816, the political climate changed again, and then the idea of a central bank started, you know, they were talking about it and so on. So the Congress agreed to charter a second Bank of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But Andrew Jackson...
He hated that. He was a populist.
Yeah.
He was the first populist that came
president,
up from...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in 1828, when he was when he was president, he vowed to kill it.
He also started the Democratic Party, really, in its form today, because that's when they had the first conventions, that's when people gathered, that's when they had political making, that you sloganeering and speeches and conventions and all that started out of his experience, because he lost the presidency before... to his arch-rival, John Quincy Adams, and he said, never again.
So anyway, he was against it. And in 1836, when the bank's charter expired, it wasn't renewed again.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have a central bank again. This is when state-chartered banks and unchartered free banks took hold during this period. They were issuing their own notes, of course, redeemable by gold. They were offering, you know, demand deposits and so on. The problem was, if you wrote a check, how would you cash it if you took it in another bank? So the New York Clearing House Association was formed to be able to actually transact the checks now. You know, if I had a check from bank
from
A,
one bank to another.
Exactly,
right.
And that's how that thing started.
Because think about it. Most in an agrarian society, you didn't have to go too far. So you and I are going to trade. I'm going to trade my corn for your beans. We all go to the same bank.
Exactly.
We're not going to go very far. But as commerce starts to grow, and suddenly I'm selling it to a bank in New York, or I'm selling goods to somebody in Kansas, their bank and my bank don't talk to each other. How are we going to trade money here?
Exactly. That was one of the... So in 1863, during the Civil War, the National Banking Act was passed, which provided for nationally chartered banks. Their responsibility was circulating notes that was backed by U.S. government. And then an amendment to the act required taxation on state bank notes that was not national bank notes. So if you were a state bank, you had to pay taxes on your notes that you issued. This way, they effectively created a national currency.
Mm-hmm. For the first time in the Civil War.
For the first time, exactly.
I didn't know that. I was a big Civil War buff. I thought I knew everything about the Civil War. I never heard of that. In the middle of our fight to whether we're going to stay a nation, somebody was smart enough to figure out we need a national currency.
Well, exactly. When you have
as
so
the nation's ripping apart.
When you have so many different banks, they all issue their own notes. It's kind of confusing. Imagine you're trying to deal with me and I have my own notes from my own bank.
I got a bunch of Wells Fargo notes. Do you want them? No, I bank at Bank of America. What am I going to do with those?
And how do I know that your bank is as good if I take your money and vice versa? So it does cause a lot of confusion.
Right.
So, although the National Banking Act was established in 1863 some stability for the measure for the currency, bank runs and financial panics continued to plug the economy until 1893.
I remember there were lots of big ones in the
80s. There were actually
in 1893 a banking panic actually triggered the worst recession in the United States that had ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who actually saved us was J.P. Morgan.
Famous J.P. Morgan.
Famous J.P. Morgan.
Comes to the rescue again.
It's interesting. I don't know very much about
him. Didn't he become Treasury Secretary about then?
I think later on. It's very interesting. He seemed to have saved the United States twice.
Mm.
And I don't know very much about him. He must have been extremely wealthy, whether he was a banker or farmer or what.
There's a book that I read about 4 or 5 years ago, Lords of Finance.
Mm-hmm.
It's an excellent read. I don't remember the name of the author right now. But it talks about all the Federal Reserve boards, like Bank of England, France, Italy, Germany and United States, and it talks about 10 years. It starts from 1910 to 1930s. Like it talks about like you know, how they all came together and the Great Depression era, too.
Well, in 1907, it was a bad year. A bout of speculation on Wall Street ended in failure, triggering a particularly severe banking panic. This is the second time J.P. Morgan came to, you know, to the rescue and to help avert disaster.
I just looked him up on Wikipedia. He's obviously a very well-known financier and banker. That's where he was. And
I wonder how he made his money, because he must have had huge amounts of money, too.
I believe let me just look up quickly here. I thought he was the person that bought out Carnegie, U.S. Steel, and turned it into the first billion-dollar corporation. That's correct. He took control.
Is that where he made his money?
Yeah. He was a businessman and banker. But in 19... I'm going to just read this to you here. I just saw something on him a while ago. He took over U.S. Steel, which he bought from Carnegie, I thought, for $500 million, something, which was an astronomical...
This is
in 1900. And it was the buyout of Carnegie's steel business, yeah. And it was in 1901, U.S. Steel was the first billion-dollar company in the world.
Wow.
So he became – he wasn't a billionaire himself, but he owned the first company worth $1 billion.
But where did he get his $500 million
from? Banking and financing. So he borrowed it and bought out Mellon, and which for this unheard of sum. Mellon was an older guy who had built U.S. Steel from nothing in Pittsburgh, and then he bought this and said, I'm going to give you, how much do you want for it? And the guy said, he was like 70 or 80, he said, I don't know, $500 million, which is an astronomical sum. Nobody had ever seen that kind of money in 1900. He said, I'll give it to you. And within a couple of years, it turned it into a billion, it doubled it and turned it into $1 billion. That was the milestone. They were the first billion-dollar company ever created, and he owned it. He turned it into that.
Second time, 1907, he came to the rescue and actually, you know, averted the disaster. And that by this time, the Americans were actually asking for some kind of banking reform. But the problem was division among different parts of the country. Conservatives and the powerful money trust in the big eastern cities, you know, they were opposing it against the progressives, which were...
Like now, the Democrat and the Republican.
Sort of, but this... Exactly.
Exactly the same thing.
Right, right.
History repeats itself.
But there was actually growing consensus among Americans that a central bank authority was needed to ensure a healthy banking system. So in 1908, the Aldrich Vreeland Act passed... This is in response to 1907 panic. And this is the one that, under the leadership of Senator Nelson Aldrich, the commission developed a bank control plan. Mm-hmm. And they wanted a central bank under public, not under, you know, private control.
Right.
But didn't we have the Great Depression in 1929?
We haven't got there yet.
Okay. We're still in the 1900s.
1912.
Before you jump forward, here's something else from Wikipedia, which I didn't know. You mentioned that he saved it twice. In 1893, the panic, and then 1907. The Federal Treasury was nearly out of gold in 1895, that first panic.
Wow.
At the depths of the panic of 1893. The Federal Treasury, out of gold, because they used to redeem it. If you came in a panic, they'd give you gold. And they went in the vault, and there wasn't much left. So Morgan had put forward a plan for the federal government itself, to buy gold from him and his European banks. And at first it was turned down, but then they came up with a thing that says here, save the Federal Treasury, blah, 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 blah. And where he and the Rothschilds sold gold directly to the U.S. Treasury to replace their depleted... As people panicked, they came in and wanted gold. It's for these notes. They were running out of gold, and he and the Rothschilds in Europe sold the Feds 3.5 million ounces of actual gold to back up the federal government and keep it from...
That's
turning into a running
small
away.
Pocket change.
That's interesting. But
much
it's interesting you mentioned he had money in Europe. I think that was one of the main things.
Because he was a banker with the Rothschilds and they were financing stuff. Okay.
So let's take a break. This is a good point to take a break.
Yeah.
And we come back and we tell you how the actual Federal Reserve was formed, which was the next step.
All right.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest, hire.
When it comes to pioneers in their respective industries, we all know the Apples, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's of the world. In the realm of recruiting, Decision Toolbox is the industry's best-kept secret. With 90% of their business from referrals and repeat customers, for over 20 years, Decision Toolbox's U.S.-based team of recruiters, sourcers, professional writers, quality personnel, and tech support has perfected a Six Sigma approach to talent management. No matter the size of the project, Decision Toolbox delivers incredible results. A cost per hire less than half of what contingency firms charge. With the winning candidate presented in an average of 14 days. All with a 12-month candidate warranty. With results like that, Decision Toolbox won't be a secret for long. Visit us at www.dtoolbox.com for more information.
All right, we're back. And the other person that he, when he combined to buy out Mellon, I didn't know this either, was the famous Charles Schwab, who at the time was a steel magnate himself.
Charles Schwab?
Yeah, he ran Bethlehem Steel, the second largest steel maker. So they merged that one with Carnegie's U.S. and turned, created U.S. Steel.
Do you think that Charles Schwab is related to the present Charles Schwab?
I'm looking down here. I think he was, yeah. So I think that all comes together here.
Steel was your, like, it's like, you know, Silicon Valley. Like, that's what steel was
at the time.
Back,
exactly.
At the time
that's where the Industrial Revolution was happening. Yes. Yeah, so. Okay, so we get to Woodrow Wilson's administration in 1912.
Okay.
And although he wasn't that knowledgeable about banking and issues, he actually solicited expert advice from Virginia Representative Carter Class, who became the chairman of the House Committee on Banking Finance. And eventually, by the end of, by December of 1912, the Federal Reserve Act was passed. And that's when they decided to, you know, 1913, Federal Reserve System is born.
So it was during Woodrow Wilson that that actually the Federal Reserve was created.
Exactly, exactly.
And it was all as a result of all the bank collapses.
Right. In December of 2000.
Previously.
December 23rd, 1913 was when President Woodrow Wilson actually signed the Federal Reserve Act into a law. A decentralized central bank that balanced the competing interests of private banks and sentiments. Now, let's talk about the actual Federal Reserve, the way it is operating today. Many of the services it provides by this, they have, you know, they have 12 different Federal Reserve banks, which are District 1 is Boston, District 2 is New York, District 3 is Philadelphia, District 4 is Cleveland, 5 is Richmond, 6 is Atlanta, 7th is Chicago, 9th is Minneapolis, 10th is Kansas City, 11th is District of Dallas.
I have a quiz for you, too.
And the 12th is District of San Francisco.
I have a quiz for both of you.
Okay.
Which state has two banks in them?
What do you mean, two banks?
Like, you know, the...
Yeah, well, I'd have to go through. When I was a coin collector, I had to memorize all of these ones, because on the dollar bill, there are those. A is Boston, B is
Missouri.
New York, C is
Missouri has San Luis and Kansas City.
Yes.
They have
right.
two banks.
I see.
Right. Here's a...
Why?
I don't know, but I just know there is.
And the other thing that I've always found strange is there's a they were created on the East Coast and moved west. The entire west and part of the United States only has one Federal Reserve in San Francisco, whereas you've got two in Kansas and you've got one Boston, New York, Philadelphia. You got three in a relatively short area of space.
I actually read that. It's because of the way the population is dispersed.
Yeah, in those days, but not in these days.
Well, even nowadays, if you look at it in the west, although we have cities like San Francisco, LA, and Seattle, and so on, but when you get a little bit towards, say, Nevada, You know, those areas, it's not that populated.
I just think it had to do with the time. 1910, the big cities were out east, and so you put banks in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. Today, you'd put them somewhere else. You put them in Phoenix, San Diego, and somewhere else.
So anyway, many of the services provided by this network of different depository, and, you know, it's similar to what banks do for the consumers.
But isn't the Federal Reserve the bank of the banks?
Exactly. They move currency and coin into out of circulation. They collect and process millions of checks each day. Mm-hmm. They provide checking accounts for Treasury. That's where the Treasury actually draws the checks from. And issue or redeem government securities. They also supervise and examine member banks for safety and soundness. And they set the monetary policy. That's when they talk about interest rates, discount rates, whether they want to sell bonds.
So let me ask you a question. Well, I'm not sure I know the answer to this. But so the feds, when Bank of America collects a check, takes in a check from Wells Fargo.
Yes, it goes through the Fed.
It goes through the
clearinghouse.
Does the Fed take any piece of that? Does the Fed make money off of that function? Or is that simply what the government provides to allow the transfer of funds from one bank to another?
Exactly.
I don't think there's a profit in that transfer.
Let me explain something. The Federal Reserve is a private bank. It's not public.
Right.
The employees are paid by the government. Not the government. It's a private bank. They charge the member banks a fee every year. And that income pays for the cost of running the federal.
So they really became, as we talked about, all these banks had, when other than the two U.S. Banks of the United States that were in for a little while in the 1700s and the 1800s, we didn't have a national currency. So every bank had its own currency. And as long as you trusted that that bank had enough gold, should we all want to come in and redeem those notes for gold at the same time, you trusted that that currency was okay and I accepted it and you accepted. Then we had bank runs, these panics where people did come in and all want their money turned into gold and the banks would run out of gold. Even the Federal Reserve ran out of gold. And they created this institution as a way to transfer money from one bank to another.
Well, they also they also created the FDIC, and what the FDIC does is also gives you some kind of, like, up to $100,000 of your money.
But that was after the Great Depression.
Well, because after they actually created the Federal Reserve, there was the Great Depression, and I mean, based on a lot of things I've read, is Federal Reserve should have done more, but they were kind of afraid of doing more.
Let's talk about what happens in a panic.
That's why the FDIC was created right after
that. Yeah, so let's talk about what happens in a panic. A panic is, for some reason, the rumor gets out, the bank doesn't have enough money. Everybody wants to go in and start, I don't trust this note anymore, I want gold.
I actually saw this in Irvine, when IndyMac Bank had a branch on the corner of Alton and Jeffries.
One morning I was going to go
to work, and there was this huge line and crowd outside the bank. That's in 2008, when everybody thought that, you know,
IndyMac cannot survive.
IndyMac did not survive. Actually, some people lost money.
Right, but it was actually taken over by another bank.
It was taken over by
FDIC, and then eventually they sold it to a group of investors.
So this was very common in those days. We had bank runs in the late 1800s.
Exactly.
We had the biggest bank run was the great stock market crash.
Exactly. Yes.
And suddenly everybody said, I want my money out, and I want it in gold. I don't want it in those funny notes anymore. And the banks didn't have enough gold to pay everybody. They were writing more than they actually had in reserve.
Exactly.
And that created a run. So that's what the FDIC said. We, as the government, will guarantee, even if that bank runs out of gold, we'll give you up to $100,000.
Up to a certain amount. That's why, actually, the FDIC was created, because a lot of people actually blame the Fed for the 1920s.
So the Fed is going to back the bank.
Difference.
We don't know good or bad. And then they started saying, well, if we're going to back the banks, then we better make sure that these banks do, that we have some regulatory power. That came first, though.
Okay? Let me correct that a little bit. The Fed doesn't back the bank. They make the regulation and rules that the banks have to go by.
That's right.
They formed an insurance company, Federal Deposit Insurance
FDIC.
Corporation. The banks, the member banks, pay every year to this insurance company. Just like me and you pay premium for our insurances, for car insurance, auto insurance. The money gets collected, and then when there's a problem with the bank, FDIC comes in and starts paying the depositors up to, it's $250,000 now. Mm. Previously it was $100,000.
Yeah, I thought it was $100,000.
And then if you are above that, you know,
you're at your own risk, yeah.
Exactly. You could get a percentage of it back. You could lose all of it. It depends on how badly.
But it was all to prevent bank runs, to make people feel secure. Even
exactly.
If this bank is in trouble, if news comes out that they're in trouble, somebody just absconded with some money or something's going on,
exactly.
Don't panic. We, the federal government, through our FDIC insurance program, will guarantee you up to $250,000 of your money.
For each account.
Individual account.
So the way the Fed controls the bank is by really upping or lowering their bank reserves, so how much money they have to keep.
Exactly,
okay,
right.
That's how they control them.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
And then
yes.
They do take over the function of printing the money now for the Federal
Reserve? Of course. The Federal Reserve actually prints the money.
So they must run the printing presses wherever they sit. We were going to ask that. We still don't know where the printing press is. I think they're in Washington now.
I want to say it's in Washington because the Federal Reserve headquarters, or where Janet Yellen and his company are, it's in Washington, D.C.
Because there used to be mints in San Francisco and a mint in Denver. So there might still, we have to look that up.
They might still be there, actually. You never
know. San Francisco's been closed, and I know New Orleans is going to close because I was a coin collector, and you can't find those. You can take tours of the old mints down there, but I don't think there's a mint anywhere except in, well, I'll have to look it up. While you're talking, I'll look up where the mints
are. So anyway, one of the questions you asked, Paul, why is there only one district in West Coast and more districts towards the East and Midwest?
Right.
The location of Federal Reserve District boundaries and of the banks within the districts were determined mostly by geographic distribution of U.S. populations at the time, which was 1913.
Exactly.
So in 1913, I'm sure there weren't...
It was all on the East Coast.
Exactly. Now, let's talk a little bit about the operation of these banks. Each district has its own president. He or she is appointed by individual bank's board of directors for a term of 5 years. The terms of the presidents run concurrently. It's interesting. They end on the last day of February in a year with one or six. In 2001, 2006, 2011, and 2016, on the last day of February, the terms of the presidents are over.
So these are the six governor or the seven?
12. 12 presidents of the districts.
I see.
Okay.
But they still have the seven members of the Board of Governors.
Those are the governors, yes. Those are the actual people in D.C. that run the whole show. But each district is run by a president, just like a bank.
So you have the FOMC consists of 12 members, right?
Right. The governors.
Seven of them are the governors.
Right.
Then you have the president of the Federal Reserve.
Five of them actually vote on that.
And there's four other people. Four of the other 11 Reserve Bank presidents?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Now, a Reserve Bank president may be appointed after serving a full term or a partial term, but they have to retire at the age of 65. However, at the option of the bank's board of directors, if they start at the age of 55, they may go on to become 70.
Wasn't that like age discrimination?
No.
Yeah.
Not really.
Why?
Why is it age discrimination?
I don't know of any job that says you can only do it up to a certain age.
They do. A lot of the public companies, they want you to retire at age 65. I know.
You got to have young people printing money here. And old people don't know how to print money. And can I'm just going to interject this because I just looked this up while we're talking about it. We keep asking how many mints are. I went to the usmint.gov site. The United States Mint operates six facilities across the United States, with each facility performing unique functions. Current facilities include the headquarters in Washington, D.C., production facilities in Philadelphia, I didn't know that, West Point, New York, I certainly didn't know that, Denver, I knew that, and San Francisco still.
So these are the places that actually print the money.
Yeah, and then they have the federal U.S. bullion deposit, the big plunk of gold, is in Fort Knox.
So
Kentucky.
When they print money, they also do the coins, I'm assuming. The
yes.
Same place?
Yes.
I see. Okay.
So it doesn't spread it up. It says each does something different. So some must do coins, some must do paper. But there's six facilities total where they do something, and one place they store all the gold.
Okay. So the Federal Reserve Board consists of seven governors, all appointed by president and confirmed by the Senate. The governors serve 14 years staggered terms to ensure stability.
Yeah, they don't all leave at once, right?
Now, the chairman and vice chairman are appointed for 4 years and may be reappointed, but there is a term limitation on that. As I mentioned before, the main responsibilities are monetary policy, analyze domestic and international economics and financial conditions of the year.
Don't they also put out some information like the Beige Report and the Fed meetings?
The chairperson actually goes in front of the Congress twice a year, plus other times if they called on to.
Current chairman is right. Janet Yellen.
Now, the board funds its operation by assessing the Federal Reserve banks.
They get a fee from them, a tax.
Exactly. Their finances are audited annually and also audited by General Accounting Office.
Now, that's what confused me, because the libertarians continually say, starting with Ron Paul, that the Fed does not been audited. So are they talking about, you're saying the Fed itself gets audited,
exactly.
But maybe the federal banks don't get audited?
No, Paul. Just like a public corporation, every year their finances has to be audited financials. Now, the General Accounting Office also has the authority to go audit that particular year's financials.
Well, see, what I can't get my head around, and maybe, like, I'm going to just ask, like, a really stupid question.
No.
You know, we talk about the Federal Reserve being the bank of the banks.
Yes.
But you didn't mention that it wasn't owned by the government. It's
right.
owned. So
it's
we
a
have a
company.
Bank of the banks that actually... Is it privately held?
Yes, they want to have that.
So who owns this?
The banks. I will get to that. The shares are owned by the member banks. One of the main reasons they have that is Fed. They want to have independence from the government. Imagine if you have a democratic, person in the office, and they want to make sure the next president is also democratic. If the bank is actually owned by the government, by the administration side of the government, they could influence it.
Yeah, but it's owned privately, I think it's worse, isn't
it? No, it's owned by the banks. It is owned by the member banks.
I mean, who owns these banks?
There are 8,339 commercial banks in the United States.
Okay. So all of these combined own...
38% of them owned... No, let me get there. You're getting ahead of me. So 38% of these 8,000 commercial banks are members of the Federal Reserve System.
Okay.
The member banks are stockholders of the Reserve Bank in their district as such, and are required to hold 3% of their capital in the stocks of the Reserve Bank. Do you see what I'm saying?
It gets more convoluted.
No.
Did you get that, Paul?
I sort of did. What shocked me, though, is of the 8,000 banks or whatever you said, only 38% of them
are member, yes. However, every bank
there's
must...
There's 60% of the banks that don't comply with the FDIC?
No, they must comply. They
don't own it.
They must if you're a bank and if you're a federally chartered bank in the United States, you must abide by the rules that the Federal Reserve sets.
Got it.
Okay.
But only 38% of the banks are actually owned the Federal
Reserve. Like stock owners.
Exactly.
They own stock in this and they get voting rights.
Exactly. And these banks must have at least 3% of their capital in their stocks of the Reserve Banks.
They got to own a chunk. They can't own one share.
So I would say, like, probably J.P. Morgan Chase owns the Federal Reserve in a certain way.
Wells Fargo, and all the other banks. 38% of our total number of banks own the Federal Reserve.
You know, there's always this conspiracy theory about the Federal Reserve.
When I said 38%, that means 3,054 banks actually own the stocks. So there's quite a large number.
I can't own the stock. You can't own the stock, but the banks can buy stock in this.
Right. In addition to these member banks, there's 17,000 other depository institutions that American people use for depositing check and bank services. These depository institutions include non-member commercial banks, savings banks, loan associations, and credit unions.
Mm.
And although they're not part of the Federal Reserve, they must abide by, and they're subject to the regulations of the Federal Reserve that says.
So the Federal Reserve still tells them, like, if there's, like, as far as their reserves and everything they have.
Exactly.
So it doesn't matter whether they're a member or not.
Well, not.
I mean, if you're a bank, you're a bank. Right. You have to, like, reserve certain reserves because of what Fed tells you.
And during the Reagan years, if I'm not mistaken, that's what led to the S&L crisis, because they either relaxed or changed the amount of money that they had to hold on reserve. So they collected all this money, and they could suddenly go crazier with it and invest it more. And they did. And they went wild and bought properties and invested in real estate and all these things, and it turned out to be a big bubble and a big bust.
Well, back in the 70s, too, all of these adjustables, they did not have a cap on them. That was part of the problem, too. So if you got a loan that was like at 5%, when the interest rate jumped to 20%, you became 20%. And that's when they actually changed the whole system. And if you do get an adjustable on your mortgage, there is always a life cap on it.
And all of these grew out of the mistakes of the 70s, the mistakes of the 80s, the mistakes of the bank runs in the late 1800s. It seems like we always do it after the fact. We react to something, just as they've tried to create things after the Great Recession here.
Yeah. Now, all member banks hold stocks in the Reserve Bank and receive dividends. But unlike stockholders in a public company, the banks cannot sell or trade their stock.
Because there's no market for it.
Well, they just can't do it.
Yeah.
Now, answer to your question that you say maybe
Chase. So is that part of the reserves also? Like if I own the Federal Reserve, is that part of my reserves?
Exactly. That's why they said minimum 3% must be there. Now, in answer to your question, because they can't trade these stocks or sell and buy, it means a large bank like, say, B of A or J.P. Morgan can go and buy a big chunk of the reserve, you know, these reserve banks and say, you know what, I own 45%. You're a small bank. You only own 2%, so I can affect the outcome.
I can change the rates and the rules to favor me.
Right.
So I'm going to buy up everybody's stock here, and I'm going to control it.
Exactly.
So it's evenly spread around.
Right. So these 3,000 banks which own it, they always own it. They can't sell or trade it. My guess is that they probably were around when this Federal Reserve was formed, and they got the stocks, and since then they've kept it. Because others don't know, you know.
Well, it doesn't sound like you can sell it or exchange it, so which means you buy it, you're stuck with
it.
You get
it,
dividends with it. You get dividends from it. It's just like public corporation. They actually pay you dividends.
Well, that and now I figure out why Federal Reserve has a zero discount rate, because it's basically
selling it to us to their members.
Where,
to
is the what happens, you
not
know,
members,
the discount,
everybody.
The
everybody.
Discount yeah, rate is what you actually is the rate that you lend money to your banks, which is zero, and then the banks turn around and lend it to us for 5-6%.
Mm-hmm. But they lend it to everybody, not just the member banks. Once you become
so
a chartered bank, it works for you. Just because you're not a stockholder, it doesn't mean you get less service from Federal Reserve, or you get more if you're you own stocks.
So let me see if I can wrap my head around this. Now, how does the Federal Reserve relate to the 12 or 13 or 11 Federal Reserve banks? Those were set up to exchange money between banks.
They own those banks. They put them in each district, Paul, so that in a particular district, the president and the people who work there, they know more about this district. The economics of each district differs. I'll give you an example. In Texas, because of the oil, maybe that district is a little bit more in depressed versus, say, in Silicon Valley, everything is booming.
Right.
That bank actually gears and tries to service that particular district based on the economics of that district.
And let me see if I got this right. So the three key functions I heard is, one, they originally created these Federal Reserve banks as a way to exchange money, as money clearing. So when I write a check to you, I'm from Bank of America and you're Wells Fargo. You deposit at Wells Fargo and they say, well, what are we going to do with this? They send it to the Fed, and the Fed somehow works out getting the money from my account, B of A, into your account in Wells Fargo.
Exactly.
So that was the first function they did. And then the second function is they control all the banks
in that district.
In that district, how much reserve they have to keep. The money they collect, how much can they turn around and reinvest or relend?
That policy is set nationally.
Right. So, and then the third thing they do is control the money supply.
On that
how much is printed.
Exactly.
Well, this is, the money supply is actually controlled by the way they set the reserves. So
it's done nationally.
Yeah.
Yes.
But they're there to set the reserves. How much do you have to have? how much money is floating around in the economy. They either contract it or they or expand it.
Yes.
And how much the banks can loan out. That's another way they expand or contract it, not just printing money.
Yes.
And they also act as this clearinghouse between different banks.
Well, don't they also, the Fed can also go buy the government securities like
or
treasury
them,
bonds,
yes.
and
or
that's what they call the quantitative
easing.
Right.
Buy or sell them, exactly.
Buy or sell.
Another way to expand or contract
when they were money supply.
When they were printing money, they were basically printing this money, and then they would go and buy the securities. So the money goes back into the economy. The securities is just a piece of paper. It comes back to them.
Right.
Or vice versa. They can actually start. The banks have to buy the securities when the government wants to sell them.
But I'm really confused here. Okay.
Oh, well, you're not alone, right?
Okay. What determines how much money they print?
They have a money supply schedule that says how much money is in the economy. All this data that you get from, say, the mortgage companies from different countries, they know what's going on in the economy. They take this data, analyze it, and they decide maybe there's too much money floating in the economy. We need to collect the money back a little bit.
So let's print less.
Print less.
Buy it up.
Exactly. Sell more securities so we take more money back in. Or vice versa. They figure, you know what, we may be going into recession. Let's print some more money, put more money at the disposal of the banks. Once the banks get the money, they start lending it. Banks...
So they can pretty much decide how much they can print or not print.
Of course.
Yeah. So
of course.
There's nothing backing this money.
Nothing. Well, no, supposedly some gold. We have some gold reserve, but not enough.
It's the U.S. government.
Yeah. The full faith of
the U.S. government.
You're trusting the U.S. government
exactly.
So big it ain't going to go broke.
Exactly. And it seems to be pretty good.
Full faith and credit.
Otherwise, Chinese wouldn't be buying
oh,
so
I'm
much.
I'm not sure where the faith is going to go when Mr. Trump becomes a president. Oh, no.
Fortunately, because this federal bank is independent, it doesn't really matter who's in the office.
Well,
Mr.
Right.
Trump, Mrs. Clinton, or whomever comes
in
the office.
She can't just say open up the printing
exactly.
presses, right?
Exactly.
I'm sure Mr. Trump will try to do that.
So it's interesting. They do control the money supply, and it isn't just through printing. It's through reserves in the bank, and then this like quantitative easing where they're buying stuff back and buying it out of.
Exactly.
So part of it's actually printing money. Some of it is allowing less of it to have to sit in the bank vault and more of it to be lent, and some of it is on the open market, creating treasury bonds or other things, buying them back
also,
or issuing
also stuff. Discount rate, Paul.
Yeah.
When they lower the discount rate, see, it's cheaper for the bank to borrow money now.
Yeah.
But banks' main job is to lend money.
Right.
That's
collect it and lend it.
Lend it. So if this cheaper for the banks to get the money to lend, of course they want to lend more.
Right.
And if the rates are lower, more people will
and if
be
they
able
raise
to
the rate, then the cost of that
exactly.
money is higher and they don't lend
exactly.
it. So they really do determine. And then this gets into the whole world of economics, which I don't know where John Kenneth Galbraith was, if he was a monetary guy. But there are different ways to look at economies. And one is monetary policy, those that fool with monetary policy.
The other one is fiscal policy.
Fiscal
yes.
policy, yes. yes, exactly.
The fiscal policy is actually done by the government. That's when they decide to increase taxes, reduce taxes. That's the fiscal policy.
Or hire more employees or fire more employees.
Exactly,
and so.
Exactly. The monetary policy is actually done by the Federal Reserve. The fiscal policy is done by the government.
And some people think that's been a great idea of monitoring the money supply, which the Fed does. And some people have said no.
Actually, honestly, when you look at it, since the Carter administration, I think the Federal Reserve has done a pretty good job of managing this.
Mm-hmm.
I know we've gone through recessions, but it wasn't actually done by the Federal Reserve. The recessions, but there were other factors that came in. So, relatively speaking, it's good that we have a central bank. It's good that they're independent. And I think they've done a pretty decent job.
I think I just want to tell our listeners, please don't worry if you're confused. The more I read about this subject, the more confused I got.
But if you have any questions, please contact us. It looks like that's it for today. Thank you for listening. Make sure you check our Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, all under OCHC Radio. And if you have any comments or concerns, please email us at OCHCradio@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for having me on the show again. It's Green Eileen giving you the green tip of the week. But before I do, I just want to share some exciting news with you. I just got back from Washington, D.C. I was there for the NAR legislative meetings, and while we were there, we were able to meet with some of our congressmen and senators, and we did have a breakfast with Senator Dianne Feinstein, and she was really proud of a bill that she would like Congress to pass regarding the storage of water in California. And when I say storage, I mean when it rains in Northern California and when the snow melts in the Sierras, all that water usually goes to lakes and reservoirs and rivers and those types of things. However, we're not able to store it as well as we should because the majority of that actually just flows out into the sea and it can't be used for the agriculture in the Central Valley. So the bill that she's proposing will allow us to have more opportunity to store that water so that it doesn't go to waste, essentially. And so the green tip of the week does have to do with storage. So when it does rain here in Southern California, all of that gets once again, goes into the storm drains and out into the sea. What about the possibility of storing that water? So when you do want to water your plants and your landscaping, you're not using fresh drinkable water, you're using your harvested water. And the way to do that is with the rain barrel. What it does, it takes all the rain that's coming off your roof or through your rain gutters, puts it in a barrel so you could store it for later and water plants usually when it's hot or when they need water. Not usually when it's hot, but just when they need water. So the Metropolitan Water District is giving a big discount on rain barrels. You could purchase them for about $75. And if you'd like more information, go to ocwatersmart.com. And there you could find all the information you need about how to purchase a rain barrel and how to utilize a rain barrel. And you could start harvesting your own water. So that is the green tip of the week from Green Eileen. Make it a great one.